Welcome to our weekly markets update from Chief Investment Officer Sonia Loud and her team here at Legal & General Investment Management. This episode was recorded earlier today and is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to our weekly CIO market update, which we're holding for our clients during this period of volatility brought on by the coronavirus outbreak. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Sasha Sedan, Director of Investment Stewardship, and David Barron, Head of Index Equity and Smart Beta. Now, investor sentiment appears to have improved in the run-up to the Easter break, which I'm sure we're all looking forward to. Sonia, could you please give us an update on the state of markets and the health of the global economy?
Absolutely, very happy to. Good morning, everyone. As always, I hope our call will find you healthy and well alongside your families. And thank you very much again for joining us today. As Max has highlighted, it clearly has been a friendlier week, not only in terms of the weather pattern, which I think we all welcome very much, but in terms of market behavior as well. It clearly feels a bit more stable and to some extent positive. And we have had some good news when it comes to the virus development, particularly here in Europe, where we heard first very supportive signs that new cases and fatalities might finally reach some sort of stable level. And hence, the attention has now been very much on what is the next step for the economy. Fatalities in particular are the kind of guiding principle we're looking at. And here we have had Italy in particular, Spain, France, Germany to some extent, and even in the UK, it seems we're approaching a phase of greater stabilization. And the reason why we are highlighting this so much is because alongside this development, we have now seen governments turn their attention to the next phase, i.e. when and how can we see lifting of the containment measures, because that obviously is incredibly important for our economic projections. As it stands, Austria will kick us off in trying, and it seems that they will start Tuesday post-Easter with the first lifting of restrictions, with more to follow on the 1st of May. Now, as we've discussed on previous calls, it is all about managing the potential second wave of new infections, because obviously those will dictate how severe future lockdown measures need to be. So all eyes on Austria, I guess, although it is fair to say that Austria's experience of COVID-19 probably has been more mild than in other European countries. Now, when it comes to the economic implications, we have had quite lively discussions over the past 2 days, because with that development in markets and in within the COVID-19 developments, it's clear that all eyes now are on the severity of the initial shock, and then furthermore, how quickly economies will be able to recover against lifting restrictions. And here we are looking very closely in what's happening in China, where we had an initial spike after they lifted restrictions in the Hubei province. But now we're seeing actually a slight setback again towards roughly, 80% of normal activity. I think we have to be honest that this is quite normal in the context of the rest of the world still being in lockdown mode, and that obviously China initially was attacked by a supply shock, which now is followed by a demand shock, because literally the rest of the world is not purchasing anything. Interestingly, it is clear that the US seems to follow very clearly the initial shock pattern in terms of the activity literally falling off a cliff, and all eyes will be on how other countries can follow this. As I said before, and you will receive the presentation post this call as usual, we have developed 3 scenarios to think about how this second phase in the economic development could look like. I think there's no doubt that the initial shock will be very severe, and we are seeing first signs of the magnitude appearing in the higher frequency data that we have been seeing across Europe. Still, it is about, in particular when it comes to assessing the attractiveness of current market levels, it is all about how quickly the recovery can take hold and how quickly economies can get back to normal. And here, obviously, the difference between the 2 scenarios that are still our key ones is in the manageability of the second wave of infections. The more successful governments and countries are in managing new infections, the faster economies will get back on track. Now, having said that, I think we have to understand that this, you know, will take a very different shape depending on what industry and companies are looking at. And I believe a lot of you will wonder whether, you know, valuation levels right now are attractive enough, whether we have seen a bottom in markets. And I believe that particular for this assessment, it's very important to understand what the long-term implications will be. We have called it economic scarring because it's very clear if you bring an economy to a complete standstill, the recovery might not look the same what it would have if the lockdown had not happened. And so we're spending a lot of time on these longer term implications, and we can probably come back to this a bit later because the opportunity set is very different depending on which asset class, which sector, and which company you're looking at. Equities, for example, very much will depend on the earnings outlook. And although expectations have been adjusted already, it's very clear that uncertainty remains at very elevated levels. And that actually, if you then compare it to the multiples we're currently seeing in markets, we might not necessarily have seen the final bottom out process yet. In credit, it's even more difficult to judge, or not really difficult, but it is there's more facets that go into the assessment of credit, because to start with, the same I've just said for equities obviously will manifest itself in the downgrade cycle and in the increase in defaults, which we're already seeing a record number of downgrade activity. But as we've discussed on last week's call, we obviously have seen unprecedented central bank support, so that you might see greater stabilization and a slightly different opportunity set than what you see in equities. One area we are focusing on is this idea that right now we are all focusing a lot on liquidity. Liquidity for individuals, for companies, liquidity within markets. And if you think about the support mechanisms that have been put in place from governments and central banks, it's very clear that most of them focus on solving the liquidity issues and the liquidity crisis. Now, with the depth of the economic fallout, it's very clear that eventually we will see this morphing into a solvency crisis because companies will struggle to get back to normal. And obviously, it's very clear the longer this the longer the lockdown goes on, the more severe the solvency crisis will be. Now, before handing back to Max, I wanted to draw your attention to one area in global markets that has not seen the level of attention that probably it should, and I'm talking about emerging markets. With a lot of the Western world being hit so badly by COVID-19, it is interesting that we have seen less attention on emerging markets, whereas in fact we have to think about very clearly how those countries will experience COVID-19 and how the response mechanism will be. If you had a look at our presentation last week, you will recall that we shared with you the fiscal responses from various countries, and you might have seen that actually emerging markets are sitting at the right-hand side of the spectrum, i.e. with lower announced fiscal measures. To some extent, this is related to the fact that some have not experienced COVID-19 as of yet and as dramatically as some European countries. And I think we have to understand as well that emerging markets might react differently to it. And there's a number of reasons for it. Social distancing in countries like India, southern India in particular, is a very different concept than what it would be in the Western world. Medical systems will look very different. On the other hand, obviously, populations in emerging markets on average are a lot younger, and there's a different social cohesion in those countries. So again, I think when trying to understand not only how emerging markets will react, but secondly, whether the market opportunity, and this is a very different concept here, the economic fallout from the market opportunity, I think is a very interesting debate that we're currently having. Because you have seen emerging market equities and bonds reacting alongside the Western world, when in fact, actually, the economic picture still is slightly different. But I think what is fair to say, it is not a homogeneous picture, and it will come down a lot to the way individual countries will react to it. Our emerging markets team does see a lot of opportunities, but we felt it is worth raising this point because it has received, you know, on average, less attention over the past couple of weeks than what we have seen, obviously, the eyes on the likes of Italy, France, and Spain. With that, I'm handing over to Max. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that update, Sonia. And I should just point out for our listeners that we've managed to attach the presentation that Sonia was just referring to the invite email we sent this morning. So you should be able to look at it at this very minute now. Moving to Sasha now, what's the role of the investment stewardship, and more broadly, what positive role can asset managers play as responsible investors at times like this?
Good morning, everybody. Let's start with, we've been talking about ESG and we've been talking about how important it is to LGIM for many years, and I've been on the board of LGIM for nearly 9 years now. And it's times like this that when we use the words long-term constructive investors, that we need to step up to the plate as well as everybody else. So, and it's not just ourselves, I'm going to talk about the industry, but asset managers have all been collaborating. I'll give you a quick example. We have helped when companies have been asking us specifically, what do we do about our AGM? What do we do about certain things if we are thinking about our dividends? So we came up, LGIM came up with a statement, private statement, just to companies. It hasn't been in the press yet, to talk about the things that we thought would be helpful for them in these unprecedented times. And we wrote to them directly and we said, if you have to do a virtual AGM, we don't like them normally because we like all investors to have the chance to go to an AGM and ask a question and keep the board to account. But in this exceptional time, you can have a virtual AGM as long as in the future you can have a retail investor day or an institutional day that people can still ask those questions that they want to. We want you to think of your stakeholders. There's so much talk about stakeholders, and it's a wonderful phrase that's used in nice growth times, but this is the time to absolutely look at your employees, look at your supply chain. And we've said that you should focus on that stakeholder primacy in these shorter term measures, because society that you operate, as we can see sadly, is so linked to the companies that we invest in. And so we're putting that onto companies and asking them to make sure that they support them. We've had massively positive views from that, and we've seen some really good companies really stepping up to the plate. And then suddenly, I think the AGM season, you just talked about that, I think it is still important that we hold companies to account, but we hold them to account for the things that matter. And a good example is that we've talked about overboarding, where companies, where board directors are on too many boards. Well, that's something we've cared about for quite a long time. But look at that now. Can you imagine if you were on 8 boards at the moment and they're all having emergency board meetings? How do you manage to do that? They might be the most wonderful person, but have they got the capacity and the ability and the energy to do the jobs that they need to on behalf of each of those companies? So these things matter, and they matter even more sadly in these times. Just briefly, just forgetting about what LGIM has been doing, we've been working with the FCA, the FRC and many of the regulators to try and help. And it's been pleasing to see the regulators coming out with statements about how companies should be helpful, putting out short-term prospectuses if they need to raise capital, and looking at the FRC about how auditors should be looking at working capital concerns to make sure that companies are fine. And they've been putting out statements to help companies. So all of these things, both from an equity and a credit side, and we've been talking to both our equity and credit investors, have been really to try and support companies and to give them some constructive advice from one of their largest investors on what things they can do. The time for accountability will be later. For now, it's time to look after your stakeholders and survive.
Thank you, Sasha. That's really interesting, looking at the things we are doing to support companies short-term and long-term to do the right thing for their stakeholders. Moving to Dave now, what are the most important takeaways for index investors from the last few weeks of market turbulence? Is it liquidity or market function or rebalancing, say?
Yeah, thanks, and good morning. So yeah, I guess, you know, when I think about it, I'd probably highlight three important things on the index side and kind of how we manage through events like this. So first, I guess it's important to highlight that somewhat obviously our objective is to match the risk return characteristics of a particular index product. But in these types of markets, you know, that has the potential to expose some cracks in portfolios, even with the smallest of deviations. So, you know, as a team, you know, we generally look to opportunistically minimize those gaps in funds and funds against benchmarks, because even a few basis points misweights in a country or a sector can seem innocuous, but really can drive a wedge in performance and our target investment objectives on the team. So very mindful of that, kind of changing the strategy. That leads into the second point, which hopefully many of those listening know, one of the central tenets of our business on the indexing side is employing, you know, a strategy we call pragmatic replication, where we're looking to minimize both cost and add value. And that's through not exactly following, you know, what the index is telling us to do during a rebalance or a corporate event. So the goal really is just to do the best we can to avoid wealth erosion, you know, in a risk conscious manner. However, given the volatility lately, we really have to be much more certain about, you know, trading away from a benchmark point, as the probability of success really diminishes quite quickly in these types of environments. So, you know, it echoes the analogy of trying to pick up pennies in front of a steamroller. What normally drives the index trade definitely wasn't driving in the month of March. You know, so suffice it to say, you know, when we looked at the FTSE rebalance, which occurred third Friday in March, we were much more conservative about our trading strategy, which proved prudent given the environment we were in. It's also worth mentioning on the index front, you know, we engage with our index providers and peers on how best to handle the kind of the March rebalances that were planned. And I think we were generally successful in minimizing what might have been additional turnover and liquidity concerns in many of the indexes, both across equities and fixed income. So that was either, you know, seeing some reductions and increases to certain country inclusion factors, or in some cases, outright postponement of the actual index rebalance. So some good news there. And then the last point, again, kind of generally on what we're watching out for on the index side is just on liquidity and how we kind of manage that. So I have to say, you know, I'm on the equity side. My fixed income counterpart, Lee Collins, was probably sweating a bit more during the month of March than I was. Closing auctions were fairly orderly on the equity side, so we didn't see as much issues. But generally speaking, you know, the team looks to increase exposure to more liquid securities, and that's in anticipation of cash flow activity or currency hedge disinvestment or reinvestment. So for the equity team, we're looking at using futures, you know, fixed income team bringing in some gilts where appropriate. And the last, you know, point to highlight is the benefit of having a close relationship with the global trading team. You know, they're really the rock in these kind of environments where we talk to them about our benchmark objective, and they help us achieve that as most efficiently as possible for our client base.
Thank you, Dave. And staying with the theme of performance and volatility, we know it's only been a relatively short period of time, but have ESG indices performed as you would have expected recently?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head there. In the index space, you know, where we have transparent rules-based methodologies, you know, most important criteria for assessing a good alternatively weighted index, you know, like one that integrates ESG criteria, is whether or not it's performed as is expected. And that's based on the objective of that index. So, you know, an index trying to achieve a lower carbon footprint, for example. So to put that into context, you know, we're trying to avoid, you know, unintended consequences in a strategy. And a classic example is if you exclude energy stocks in an index and rescale, you know, in a market cap fashion, you end up with overweights to technology, financials, and healthcare stocks. And that overweight might actually drive performance more than your intended underweight to energy. So it's important to really understand if there are unintended consequences in an ESG index and any alternatively weighted index for that matter. But on the point of performance, I guess, you know, over the period, I can say generally, yes, the kind of the indexes that we've observed have performed as expected. Generally is a really important qualifier because at this point we're estimating there's a couple hundred thousand ESG indexes running around, lots of choice, so hard to narrow that down. But to elaborate, I guess, on some of the construction aspects, of an ESG index, you know, think on the climate side, you're probably fairly underweight oil and gas majors, airlines, and cruise liners, which wouldn't have been such a terrible thing in March, given the impact of the lockdowns and oil dispute and some of the points Sonia's been touching on. So we've seen many of the flagship ESG index strategies that are fairly closely tied to market cap deliver returns either on par with market, so obviously down for the month of March, or slightly better, so down but better by 50 to 60 basis points. But the last point I think important to leave everyone with is, you know, we really shouldn't focus too much on the short-term performance, especially in some of these index products. You know, many of the themes in ESG is that they're long-term in nature. You know, we're not saying the energy transition just happened in the month of March and you know, all is well. So I think, you know, it should be expected that you know, some of these products bounce around as markets continue to stabilize.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Dave. Thank you for stressing that, the importance of a long-term view here. On that note, let's move back to Sonia. Sonia, you touched on this earlier. What industries do you think will see the most fundamental changes once we come out the other side of this crisis, and where do you see investment opportunities?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Dave has mentioned a few very important ones already, because it's very clear that once we are seeing restrictions being lifted, that the economic recovery will not be even. It simply can't be, because we've now been told to distance ourselves from other human beings for so long. That obviously will not go away overnight, because I stressed so much the importance of managing the second wave that it's very clear that governments will try and sensitize people to remain distant. And that means that obviously the economic recovery and the lifting of restrictions will see a very uneven picture in terms of the opportunity set for companies. You know, cruise liners, airlines, anyone for summer holidays, that's all events. The whole idea around socializing, going out, traveling, I believe will take a lot longer to recover, simply because we will be very worried about the impacts that will linger in the backdrop, that of course there is still the risk of catching the virus. And I believe that those companies will face a far longer kind of drought in terms of their activity, and hence coming back to my liquidity morphing into a solvency problem, that's areas we have to watch very carefully. From a manufacturing point of view, I think we should see us going back to work, if we put it very bluntly, as an immediate means of lifting restrictions. And as such, obviously, this is where we expect the recovery to happen first. And so you can see that consumption-related, and particular consumption services-related sectors will probably suffer quite a bit longer. And this is hence our focus right now. If you remember what I said around obviously downgrade activity, expected defaults, earnings expectations, and the earnings recession that we're going to see, it is very important to understand what makes a viable business proposition post COVID-19. And I think we have to be very open to trying to understand what longer term implications are, and whether there's even longer term implications in terms of consumer behavior, consumption patterns. Given that we had to do everything online now, will this change even further post COVID-19? Thinking about working from home, the flexibility that we had to ask everybody to adopt might shift in the context of people asking for greater flexibility post COVID-19. Hence the question around, you know, do we all need that level of office space in the city of London? So lots of questions that we're trying to address to understand what economic scarring will remain, and as such, we will have to adjust our company models in that context. And so this is what the teams really are focusing on right now, to make sure that we are capturing the right context here. And this is obviously how it links back to what Sasha has said, because we clearly do have a responsibility to be part of that journey and to help companies, because it is a very difficult time. Lots of companies have to make very tough decisions, and it's our responsibility to not only try and help understand what viability looks like, but secondly, to be there to provide capital as well.
The whole point of our reason of being and being asset managers should also be, maybe we do have an ESG index, and maybe we do have tilts in the way that we do, but then we should then accountability, have those companies done what they said they've done? If they've said that they've cared about their stakeholders and we're pushing them, well, we will find out in this period whether they have done that. And we will use our influence, whether it's in our credit team, our index team, equity team, or our voting, to push them and to show that we are not happy with certain things, and also support the ones that have done a fantastic job. So it's not just picking a stock and leaving it there.
Right. This is a great point for me to ask you about our active ownership report, which is due out in a couple of weeks, Sasha. Which of its themes from last year do you think will resonate most with clients in this current environment?
Thanks, Max. Well, you've been very deeply involved. This is the ninth year we've done this report, so we've certainly showed our colours of caring about this for a long time. And obviously, the demand for this kind of discussion has grown exponentially. I'd say some of the points are exactly the same things that we would have talked about for a while. If you think about, we've talked about stakeholders and employees and living wage and the things that happen for companies as part of the society they operate. We pushed a lot, and that's in the report this year, obviously written before this terrible time, but that will definitely be something that will be very pertinent. The fact that we pushed our own regulators to make sure that companies talk in their annual report, and the annual report is for clients, it's for their money, it is their report, about how they are actually looking after their stakeholders and writing it down and showing examples of what they're doing, because having a policy doesn't mean anything. And then the one that we push very hard and is going to be a big thing is the chair and CEO split. We find it very strange that in this day and age, with the biggest complicated companies that are so linked with so many other things, including the economies and all the things that we've seen, how could one person, even if they are amazing, run a company, operate the company, execute the strategy and come up with the strategy and be in charge of marking their own homework? We find that incredulous. And therefore, we want to have challenge at the top of the companies to make sure they can do as best they can. And then, of course, in this awful environment, it's very hard to be running everything at the moment when you've got so many different variables that we've never thought of, as Sonia has thought before. How could you do all of that? So all of those are in our active ownership report that comes out in 2 weeks. And I think there will be things that care. And I haven't even mentioned one that both speakers have mentioned, which is climate change. We're obviously pushing very hard on climate change. It is amazing to see how things can change. It's amazing to see how we can work differently if we have to. And I think things will be different when we hopefully get back to more normality. And people will think that we can do things differently because we've had to in the past, and we'll see that it is quite important.
Thank you, Sasha. Yes, there is masses more detail in the report, which is due out in about 2 weeks' time. Sonia, is there anything you'd like to add before we finish up here?
Thank you, Max. I wanted to say thank you to a lot of you clients who are in touch and who are reaching out to speak to us. We are very grateful for the ongoing activity, the engagement, the interactions and discussions. So please continue. If you have any questions, if you would like to pick up anything that we discussed today on the call, we are here to help, and the client teams and the investment teams are delighted and happy to help with any of the problems you might face. And that only leaves me to wish you, hopefully, a very, very relaxing and wonderful Easter weekend. I think we all need a little bit of time off after some very, very intense weeks. So wishing you a wonderful time, and very much looking forward to speaking to you next week on Thursday. Thank you.
Thank you, Sonia. I couldn't agree more. And let's finish up on that point. I'd like to thank you, Sasha and Dave, for your time today. And I'd like to thank our clients for dialing in. As ever, if you have any questions that you'd like to put to our panel next week, please let your usual LGIM representative know.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.